Isaiah, chapters 51, 52, and 53. The 32nd talk in a series on Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on May 4, 2014 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be starting in Isaiah chapter 51. Last week, we did two of the servant songs. There are four servant songs in this section of Isaiah. The servant songs are these passages that talk about the servant. It's not clear who the servant is, but our information about the servant grows with each song a little bit. And my hope is to get to the fourth and last of the servant songs today. That starts in chapter 52 and then goes through chapter 53. And then I would like to talk about the servant songs as a whole. And basically, I want to summarize some things that I have been pulling together as we're going through Isaiah, some thoughts about the interpretation of this kind of literature. So we'll see how far we get, but we might get through three chapters today. We left off in chapter 50. The last two verses of that chapter gives us a contrast between two different kinds of people. One is described in verse 10, that is, one who fears the Lord. And the other is described in 11, one who kindles a fire. And the contrast that it's making is that the first kind of person is one who fears the Lord, and it says, obeys the voice of his servant, and yet walks in darkness and has no light. So this is someone walking in darkness, that is, there's the lack, can't see, there's no light, can't see, but someone who fears the Lord and obeys the voice of his servant. And what it says with respect to that person is, let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. That's what such a person in that situation ought to do. That's contrasted with someone who kindles a fire. And here the idea is, I think, someone who's in the darkness also, but trying to make their own light. That they're doing whatever they can to generate their own light to deal with the darkness. And the fate of such a person is that this person is going to be encircled with firebrands and will walk in the light of your fire among the brands. And God is going to set those ablaze, and such a person will lie down in torment, being consumed by the fire. And Isaiah has used fire as a symbol for judgment many times throughout the course of the book. So, two different people, both walking in darkness. One is fears the Lord and obeys the servant, and such a one is called upon to trust in the name of God. The other one tries to generate their own light, and their fate will be that fire will consume them. 51 then starts out speaking to that first category, one who fears the Lord. Okay, first section. Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and to the quarry from which you were dug. Look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah who gave birth to you in pain. When he was one, I called him. Then I blessed him and multiplied him. Indeed, the Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and her wilderness he will make like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and sound of a melody. So he's speaking to those who fear the Lord, who pursue righteousness. And he uses, apparently the issue is, will God do what he has said that he will do? Will God bring about the justice and righteousness that he has said that he will bring about and make available? And he appeals to an example from history. And he says, look to the rock from which you were hewn. The rock from which they were hewn, it's Abraham and it's Sarah. That God came to Abraham when Abraham was old and childless. God came to Abraham and blessed him and said, I will make you a great nation. An unlikely promise. A promise that didn't look like it could be fulfilled. God waited another 25 years, and then Abraham and Sarah had a child. One child, and over time, from that one child then, came a whole people. So Isaiah is pointing to that example. He's saying, look back at history. There was a situation in which it looked like God would not be able to fulfill the promise that he made, but he did. He started out with Abraham and Sarah when they were already old. Abraham was only one, and yet he made of him a great nation. So we can count on the fact that God will comfort Zion. God will bring about the promises that he has made. And he's going to comfort all her waste places. And the wilderness he's going to make like Eden, the desert like the garden of the Lord. So God is going to take, he's envisioning then this Zion as being just an area of waste places. The Jews have been removed for the most part, and there are many empty places now in Zion and in Jerusalem. But God is going to fulfill his promises. He's going to bring comfort to Zion, and he's going to make what is now a wilderness, he's going to make it like Eden. It's going to be like a new creation. He's going to take the desert and make it like a garden, the garden of the Lord. So it's going to be a new creation that is going to be brought about. And as a result, there will be joy and gladness, thanksgiving, and sound of a melody. The next section. Pay attention to me, O my people, and give ear to me, O my nation. For a law will go forth from me, and I will set my justice for a light of the peoples. My righteousness is near, my salvation has gone forth, and my arms will judge the peoples. The coastlands will wait for me, and for my arm they will wait expectantly. Lift up your eyes to the sky, then look to the earth beneath, for the sky will vanish like smoke, and the earth will wear out like a garment, and its inhabitants will die in like manner. But my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not wane. Listen to me, you who know righteousness, a people in whose heart is my law. Do not fear the reproach of man, neither be dismayed at their revilings. For the moth will eat them like a garment, and the grub will eat them like wool. But my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation to all generations. Throughout this section, there are a lot of imperatives that are used. Pay attention. Here is an imperative, a command that's being issued. We saw in the first section, listen to me. And we'll see a lot more before we're done. And oftentimes they are said two times. They are repeated, suggesting that there's some passion behind what Isaiah is saying in this section. So pay attention to me, give ear to me, my people. Then he says, a law will go forth from me, and I will set my justice for a light of the peoples. This is interesting in that in the verse before, he had likened what he was going to do in Zion to a new creation. He's going to make a new Eden, a new garden of the Lord. So a recreation, a new creation. And now we have another allusion to the creative activity. He's going to send forth the law and his justice for a light of the peoples. So the light is being used to shine into this darkness. Well, there was another time when God shone light into darkness, when he created the earth to begin with. So I think that we're seeing clues here that Isaiah is likening what God will do to creation at the beginning. And he assures them that righteousness is near and his salvation has gone forth. It's imminent. It's going to happen. God is going to bring his righteousness. God is going to bring about the salvation that he has promised. It talks about my arms will judge the peoples. We'll see other references to his arm indicating his activity, his God being active. He's going to judge the peoples. The coastlands will wait for him, and they'll wait expectantly for his arm. The whole world will be judged and will be waiting for what God is going to do. Then he has the listener do a little exercise. Lift your eyes up to the sky and down to the earth. Look at the created order. Look at the cosmos above and below. That is all going to vanish. That is all temporary. It's all going to disappear. And the inhabitants are going to die. But God's salvation and his righteousness, they will never disappear. They are permanent. So if you look at the creation out there, the created order, what God created in the beginning of Genesis, that's all going to go. It looks like that's permanent, but it's all going to go. What's permanent, will last forever, is God's righteousness and God's salvation. So, speaking to the people then who pursue righteousness, those who know righteousness, those who have the law as their heart, he says, don't worry about people. Don't worry about their mocking of you, their reproach for you, because they are going to disappear. They're all going to vanish. The moth, like the moth eats a garment or a grub eats wool, they will disappear. But God's righteousness and his salvation, those will exist forever. Those are things that are permanent. Next section. Awake, awake. Put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not thou who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Was it not thou who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a pathway for the redeemed to cross over? So the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion, and everlasting joy will be on their heads. They will obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Now this is apparently Isaiah speaking with respect to God, and he's saying, he's calling God to action. He says, awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. We'll see several more references to God's arm, his God in action. The arm stands for God being active. Isaiah is calling on God to be active. And then he says, like in the olden times, like in the days of old. And it says, was it not thou who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Now Rahab, the word means arrogance. Isaiah has used the word Rahab earlier, the name Rahab earlier, referring to Egypt. But Rahab that's the name of the sea serpent, the serpent, the dragon that lives in the sea in Canaanite mythology. In Canaanite mythology, there is this monster that lives in the sea, And this monster is chaos itself. And it stirs up the sea and makes trouble, and it makes the sea spill over its boundaries and flood the land. And in Canaanite mythology, Baal is the one whose job it is to put Rahab in his place. So he fights with Rahab, and he kills him. And by doing that, Baal subdues chaos and makes it possible for there to be order. And order is what's necessary for there to be life and for life to go on. So this seems to be referring to the Canaanite mythology. Now, I don't think that Isaiah is suggesting that he believes the story, but he's drawing upon the story as part of his cultural vocabulary, that God subdued chaos, like in the story of Rahab, of Baal subduing Rahab. It goes on then in verse 10 and moves to a different analogy, drawing upon the fact that Rahab sometimes stands for Egypt. Then in verse 10, was it not thou who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a pathway for the redeemed to cross over? Now it's talking about the Exodus. In verse 9, it's wasn't it you, God, that brought order into the chaos of creation? In verse 10, it's wasn't it you, God, who split the sea so that your people could pass through on dry land? Two of the big acts that God has done in history, dramatic acts that God has done in history. Okay, wasn't it you that did those, God? Okay, so now the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion. Apparently here referring to the return of the Jews from Babylon, from exile in Babylon. So he's saying, just as you have acted in the past, now act to bring your people back from Babylon. But then it goes on, and everlasting joy will be on their heads. They will obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. He says, and everlasting joy. That sounds like in the end, in the eschatos. I mean, only then will there be everlasting joy. Any other joy is only temporary in this life. So he seems to be referring then to the end of time. And we've seen this before, and I've talked about this, that as you read through in Isaiah, it will appear to be talking about something close to the time of Isaiah, but then it will use language that seems to be too grand to fit there. It seems to be hyperbolic. It seems to be talking about infinite kinds of things. And I think that that's a clue that at this point, the author is talking about something at the end of time. If that's true, then what's happening in this passage is similar to what we've seen in lots of places in Isaiah. He moves from creation, and then he talks about the Exodus as two acts of God in the past that show God's ability and willingness to act on behalf of his people. Likens that to the return from exile in Babylon, and then hints at how that is like what will happen at the end of time. So four things are all being compared in a very short passage. And I will talk more about that next week. Next section. I, even I, am he who comforts you. Who are you that you are afraid of man who dies, and of the Son of Man who is made like grass, that you have forgotten the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth, that you fear continually all day long because of the fury of the oppressor as he makes ready to destroy? But where is the fury of the oppressor? The exile will soon be set free and will not die in the dungeon, nor will his bread be lacking. For I am the Lord your God, who stirs up the sea and its waves roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. And I have put my words in your mouth and have covered you with the shadow of my hand to establish the heavens, to found the earth, and to say to Zion, you are my people. Again, this passage starts with a repetition, I, even I. So he's being quite emphatic here. I'm the one who comforts you. I'm the one who brings salvation and righteousness. Those are the things that he's been talking about. Does it make any sense for you to be afraid of man who is merely mortal and the son of man who is made like grass? Your fear is of man, and yet he's going to pass away. Don't forget who I am. I am the maker. I am the one who created this thing, stretched out the heavens, laid the foundations of the earth. I am the one who created this universe and you. Does it make any sense for you to be fearful of your oppressor, of your human oppressor, and the things that that oppressor is making ready and the ways in which he would like to destroy you? But when it comes down to it, where is the oppressor? Where is the fury of the oppressor? It melts into nothingness against me. The exile, that is, those in Babylon, will soon be set free. They aren't going to die there. They aren't going to die in prison. And they will not be lacking in bread. Remember, in the Exodus, God made sure that his people were not lacking in bread. They had food to eat throughout the time that they were in the wilderness. For I am the Lord your God, who stirs up the sea and its waves roar. I'm not sure why this imagery is here, that God is the one who stirs up the sea. I know that there are other instances where the sea stands for the peoples and the peoples in the rebelliousness against God. And it could be that that is the significance here, but I'm not sure. Then in verse 16, it says, I have put my words in your mouth. The you there in Hebrew, there's a distinction between you plural and you singular. We don't make that distinction. Only in the South do they make that distinction, you and you all. We don't make that distinction in the enlightened Northwest. But in Hebrew, they make the distinction between the singular and the plural, and this you is singular. Furthermore, it's singular masculine. So it creates a problem trying to figure out who the you is in this verse. It could be Israel. It could be Isaiah. But my suspicion, as we look at the rest of this verse, my suspicion is that this is a reference to my servant. He says, I will put my words in your mouth. So God is going to give to this person, and I think it's the servant, the words to say. And God has covered him, this person, or these people, with the shadow of my hand. So he's protecting this, and I think the servant, to establish the heavens, to found the earth, and to say to Zion, you are my people. So if this is the servant, then what is being said is God is going to give the servant the words to speak and the protection that the servant needs in order to establish the heavens, found the earth, in order to make a new creation, and to say to Zion, you are my people. Okay. The next section. Rouse yourself, rouse yourself. Arise, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the Lord's hand the cup of his anger, the chalice of reelings you have drained to the dregs. There is none to guide her among all the sons she has borne. nor is there one to take her by the hand among all the sons she has reared. These two things have befallen you. Who will mourn for you? The devastation and destruction and famine and sword, how shall I comfort you? Your sons have fainted. They lie helpless at the head of every street. Like an antelope in a net, full of the wrath of the Lord, the rebuke of your God. So now the call is for Jerusalem to get ready, to wake up from its sleep, to rouse itself from. And it's not just sleep here at this point. It's like arousing itself from its drunkenness. And it is as if Jerusalem has been given drink to drink, alcohol to drink. It calls it a chalice of reelings. So something that's going to make the head spin. So Jerusalem has drunk from this cup, which is the anger of God. So Jerusalem has been given this cup that represents the anger of God, has drunk it, and has become drunk, inebriated. And at this point, there is none to guide her among all the sons she has borne. She's had children, but there are none there who can help her recover and get going again from her drunkenness. Her sons are all gone. There are two things that have befallen you, speaking about Jerusalem. There are two things that have befallen you. Now, it's hard to figure out what these two things are. It goes on to talk about four things. So there's the possibility that it's talking about the four things, but in two groups. So devastation and destruction would be one of the two things, and famine and the sword would be the second of the two things. That could be what Isaiah is doing. But I think not. There is an and between each of these. They are not separated into two pairs, but it is devastation and destruction and famine and sword. So I'm inclined to think that the two things are not those four. I'm inclined that the two things are, now I hope I can go back and find the two. He talked earlier, I think it was in 49, about two things that would befall Babylon. I'm going to have to look in my notes. But there were two things that would befall Babylon. And the two things were going to be childlessness and becoming a widow. I would have to go back through my notes and find it, so I won't bother. But there were, and it referred to those as the two things. My suspicion is that those are the two things here. That two things have befallen Jerusalem, those same two things, being deprived of her children and widowhood. She's all alone. So it says, who will mourn you? How shall I comfort you? Your sons have fainted. They lie helpless at the head of every street like an antelope in a net. They're trapped. They can't help you. They're nowhere to be found. They're full of the wrath of the Lord, the rebuke of your God. So that's the plight that Jerusalem is in and being called to come out of that. Next section. Therefore, please hear this, you afflicted, who are drunk, but not with wine. Thus says your Lord, the Lord, even your God, who contends for his people. Behold, I have taken out of your hand the cup of reeling, the chalice of my anger. You will never drink it again. And I will put it into the hand of your tormentors, who have said to you, lie down that we may walk over you. You have even made your back like the ground and like the street for those who walk over it. So God is saying, You who are drunk, not drunk with wine, but drunk with my discipline, this is what God says to you. The God who is your is the one who fights for you, the one who contends for you. I have taken out of your hand the cup of reeling. So God has taken that away. That discipline that Jerusalem is drunk with, God has taken that away. It's no longer going to afflict them. And you will never drink that again. So you're never going to experience that God's anger again. And instead, he's going to take that cup and put it in the hands of those who tormented Israel. They're the ones who will drink of God's anger. And those who tormented Israel, it says, they are the ones who said to you, lie down that we may walk over you. And there is historical evidence that the Egyptians did this, and probably some of the other nations did it as well. They would take their defeated enemy and lie them down next to each other and then ride a chariot over them. The king would ride a chariot over them like over a corduroy road. So God says, to your tormentors, the ones who treated you like that, they will now have the chalice. They will now drink of God's wrath. Okay. Next chapter, first part. Awake, awake, clothe yourself in your strength, O Zion. Clothe yourself in your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For the uncircumcised and the unclean will no more come into you. Shake yourself from the dust, rise up, O captive Jerusalem. Loose yourself from the chains around your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. For thus says the Lord, you were sold for nothing, and you will be redeemed without money. For thus says the Lord God, my people went down at the first into Egypt to reside there. Then the Assyrian oppressed them without cause. Now, therefore, what do I have here, declares the Lord, seeing that my people have been taken away without cause? Again, the Lord declares, those who rule over them howl, and my name is continually blasphemed all day long. Therefore, my people shall know my name. Therefore, in that day, I am the one who is speaking. Here I am. So God is calling Zion then to prepare itself for a change. There's going to be a significant change in their situation that is going to take place. In this first two verses, it starts out with a structure that is, I will just mention it because it's so common in Isaiah. I have not pointed it out every time that it occurs, but it's called a chiastic construction because it starts out with, the pattern is 1, 2, 3, and then it reverses itself, 3, 2, 1. And it could be any number, it could be up to 10 the same way, but what it starts with is what it ends with. And we have that kind of construction here. It talks about Zion at the beginning. It talks about Zion at the end. It tells Zion to do something, and then it ends. Just before it talks about Zion, it tells Zion to do something. And you can see, so that's the pattern that it's following. In the first half, it's telling Zion and Jerusalem to put things on to prepare themselves for this change. So clothe yourself in strength and clothe yourself in beautiful garments. So that's two things that those cities should put on to prepare themselves for this change that's coming. And then it's two things at the end, it's two things that they should get rid of. It's shake yourself from the dust and loose yourself from the chains around your neck. In the middle, it says, for the uncircumcised and the unclean will no more come into you. So prepare yourselves for a time that's coming when no longer will there be any of the unclean in your midst. You'll be purified. In verse 3, then, it talks about two situations in which God's people were taken away and they had no right to do so. You were sold for nothing and you will be redeemed without money. There was no legal claim to them. And that's true of Egypt. When they were taken into Egypt, Egypt had no legal claim to them. It was true when the Assyrians took them away. The Assyrians had no legal claim to them. And now the situation is the same. The people that in Babylon, they have no legal claim to God's people. Furthermore, in Babylon, they howl over them and they blaspheme God's name all day long. So since they have no claim and since they blaspheme God, God is going to act. And he says, my people shall know my name. Therefore, in that day, I am the one who is speaking. Here I am. In other words, I'm here to do what I need to do. I'm here to respond to your cries. So he's going to act. Next section. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace and brings good news of happiness, who announces salvation and says to Zion, your God reigns. Listen, your watchmen lift up their voices. They shout joyfully together, for they will see with their own eyes when the Lord restores Zion. Break forth. Shout joyfully together, you waste places of Jerusalem. For the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has bared his holy arm in the sight of all the nations, that all the ends of the earth may see the salvation of our God. So here it is a song of rejoicing. It starts out with, and we're talking about this change. God, just in verse 6, says God has said that he's going to act. So now this next section is rejoicing in the fact that God is acting. It's how lovely are the feet of those who bring good news. Good news here is the word that becomes in the New Testament, gospel. So blessed are the feet of the person who comes bringing good tidings, good news, who announces peace. The word here is shalom. Elsewhere, that's translated well-being. It's that things being the way they ought to be, things being the way they were intended to be. So this messenger is coming, bringing good news of this peace and good news of happiness and announcing salvation and saying to Zion, your God reigns. So this is announcing the time when God rules. God sets things right. God makes things righteous. And the feet of that messenger are indeed lovely. Then it says, listen, your watchmen, they are lifting up their voices. They are shouting joyfully. I assume that the picture is watchmen who are on the city walls looking out, and they see it coming. And as a result, they're shouting joyfully because it's coming. And they are going to see it with their own eyes when God restores Zion. So, everybody break out in joyful shouting. And here it's speaking to the waste places of Jerusalem. We've seen several mentions of the waste places of Jerusalem. So these places that are just empty in Jerusalem, they're just rubble. They are supposed to shout out joyfully because it's coming. It's going to happen. And those waste places are going to become like the Garden of Eden. And now it's speaking in the past, and this is sometimes referred to as the prophetic past, but this is speaking in the past, but this is stuff. It's a description of what's going to happen when salvation comes. God has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. He has bared his holy arm. So once again, he has acted. He has used his arm. And we'll see in the next chapter, there will be a reference that's referring back to this holy arm being bared. And this has been done in the sight of all the nations, that and the whole world can see what God is doing when he acts with his holy arm and brings salvation. Next section. Depart, depart, go out from there. Touch nothing unclean. Go out of the midst of her. Purify yourselves, you who carry the vessels of the Lord. But you will not go out in haste, nor will you go as fugitives. For the Lord will go before you, and the Lord of Israel will be your rear guard. So he says, leave, leave. Again, it's repeated twice. There's an urgency here. He's being emphatic. Go out from there. And the obvious there here would be Babylon. Leave. Touch nothing unclean. Why? Because you need to be pure. And why do you need to be pure? Because you are carrying the vessels of the Lord. So leave. Don't touch anything to make yourself impure. You are carrying God's instruments. It sounds a little bit like when Lot and his family left Sodom and Gomorrah, and they weren't supposed to look back. And it's also a little bit like what we saw earlier when it says, go forth from Babylon, flee from the Chaldees. However, in this instance, it makes it clear that you don't have to run, you don't have to hurry, you don't have to go out as fugitives, because God will be protecting you and he will make sure that you are guarded in the rear. Okay, the next verse then begins the last of the servant songs. It starts in verse 13 of 52 and it continues until the end of 53. Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, my people, so his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. For what had not been told them, they will see, and what they had not heard, they will understand. Okay, behold my servant. So once again, this is with respect to this servant that has been referred to in all of these servant songs in this section of Isaiah. He is going to, it says, he will prosper. He will be successful. He will be successful and he will be lifted up and greatly exalted. And this expression, greatly exalted, doesn't occur very many times in the Old Testament. It occurs four times in Isaiah and in four other times besides this. And in each case, it refers to Yahweh. So the servant is going to be greatly exalted also. And just as many people were astonished at you, and that's in the plural, so apparently in reference to Israel, so his appearance, that is the servant's appearance, was marred more than any man. He didn't look very attractive. He doesn't look appealing. Interestingly, it is said of both Joseph and David in the Old Testament that they were attractive. They were beautiful of form. The servant, it says, his appearance is marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So he is not attractive. In verse 15, my translation says, thus he will sprinkle many nations, but this same verb can mean to astonish or amaze. And my suspicion is that that's the meaning here. He will amaze many nations. He's going to surprise people. He will surprise the world. The kings will shut their mouths on account of him. So although he is marred of appearance more than any man, he will amaze many nations because of his success. We'll see what his success is later. But he doesn't look like he will be able to accomplish anything of significance, and yet he will amaze the world. And I think that that's the comparison here when it started out, just as many were astonished at you, my people. Israel started out not a people. Israel started out not very promising, not very auspicious looking. It didn't look like much would come of them. But something great did come of them. They did become a great people. Similarly, the servant starts out marred more than any man. He doesn't look very promising. He's not attractive. And yet, everyone will be astounded at what they see. For what had not been told them, they will see, and what they had not heard, they will understand. What they didn't know about in advance, they will come to know, and they will recognize what he's done. Next section. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hid their face. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. So who believed this? Who believed what was announced? And to whom was God's activity, was it revealed and made manifest and made apparent? He started out in a way that it looked like nothing would come of him. There would be nothing of significance that would come of this servant. He grew up like a tender shoot, a vulnerable plant that would be easily killed. Like a root out of parched ground, dry ground, it doesn't look like anything's going to grow. He has no stately form or majesty. There's nothing charismatic about him. There's nothing appealing. There's nothing that looks very promising there. Therefore, because there was nothing attractive there, nothing that looked promising, he was despised and forsaken. People rejected him. And I'll point out in 49:7, this was in the second of the servant's songs. It said, quite inexplicably at the time, it says, "Thus says the Lord, the Redeemer of Israel and its Holy One, to the despised one, to the one abhorred by the nation, to the servant of rulers." So it just threw that at us in that song, and now it makes it a little bit more clear what's happening. The servant is not attractive. He doesn't look very promising, and therefore people reject him. He's a man of sorrows. He's acquainted with grief. He's the kind of person that people don't want to look at. And he was despised. Next section. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him. And by his scourging we are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. So in this section, it's talking about this servant suffering the punishment that each of us deserves. He bore our griefs and our sorrows. And while he was bearing our griefs and our sorrows, We looked at him, saw him suffering, and our response was, yick, he must be cursed of God. I don't want anything to do with him. He was pierced through for our transgressions. This verb, pierced through, means skewered. Usually it results in death when that verb is used, but not always. He was pierced through for our transgressions. So he's taking upon himself not just our griefs and our sorrows, but our wrongdoing, our transgression and our iniquities. He was crushed for our iniquities. He was pulverized. And all of that fell on him for our well-being, our shalom, again is the word there. So it's by his scourging, it's by the discipline that he endures that we are healed. We, like sheep, have all wandered off. We've gone our own way. We have not been obedient followers of God. We've gone our own way. But God caused our sins to fall on him, with the result that our straying is not held against us. Next section. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter, and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? For the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due. His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. So he was oppressed, he was afflicted, but he didn't cry, this isn't fair. He didn't fight to try to keep from being afflicted. He was gentle and he was submissive, like a lamb that's led to slaughter and like a sheep that's silent before its shearers. He didn't even open his mouth. He was taken away for judgment and oppression and was childless and cut off from the land of the living. So he dies without any seed. All of that because of the sin of the people who deserved that punishment. As a result, his grave should have been that of a wicked man. He should have died the death of a wicked man, but he didn't. He died the death of a rich man because he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. And the last section. But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring. He will prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors. So God crushed him. And if he, the servant, would offer himself as a guilt offering, then he would see his offspring, so he'd have children, and his days would be prolonged. So the things that said was true of him, that he was childless and cut off from the land of the living, those have been fixed. Those have been turned around. And the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. Things will go right. As a result of the anguish of his soul, He will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many as he will bear their iniquities. So their iniquities will be dealt with, will be taken away through the anguish of his soul. Therefore, his destiny is actually a great one. He will have a grand inheritance. He will divide the booty with the strong because he submitted to the death that God called him to and allowed himself to be numbered with the transgressors, that he in his death bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors. That's an amazing passage written by Isaiah long before the time of Jesus, and yet describes what Jesus did in pretty clear terms, I think. Okay, there's just a few minutes for questions. If you have questions, be glad to, or comments, be glad to take those.
I'm trying to find the section where you said, I'm not sure what's going on here, and you were referring
just one?
To... Yeah, just one. I was referring to the ocean, the sea being wild and chaotic.
Yes, that's in verse 15 of 51.
Do you have guesses?
Well, I think it's the sea there is the nations in their rebelliousness against God are sometimes referred to as the sea. So I think the idea here is even those things that are happening out there in the world that look like they are so big that no one could stand up to them, those are actually God's, that's actually God's activity, that God's bringing that about. That's fully in his control. And so the point there, I think, is I don't know exactly what they're experiencing in Babylon, but presumably what they're sensing is here, Babylon is a power that is so great that nothing could save us from them. We are stuck here in captivity forever. We cannot be freed. And God is saying, that's not true. That's not the way it is. That in fact, I have power over that.
I was thinking that if the Baal and Rahab story was really well known, that there's kind of a nice echo there too, that there is someone who is successful in combating the
that,
chaos.
That has power over, control over that. And that could be.
Yeah.
That could be.
Anyway, thanks. Mm-hmm.
David, when you first started off, the end of 50, and you talked about the darkness, and we talked about, it seemed like, two different sets of people, believers and non-believers. My question is, exactly what's the darkness that we're talking about? Is that the looking at the world around us and seeing the hopelessness of what's going to happen if it's just left up to man himself? Or what? I'm assuming it wasn't just talking about the Jews in Babylon. I mean, it was, or maybe it was. I'm not sure.
Well, I think the darkness is a spiritual, it's talking about a spiritual condition in which we can't find our way spiritually. And that what God is doing is shining light into that darkness, that he's bringing the way. And it talks about him bringing, I hadn't thought of this before, but it talks about him bringing the law. I don't remember where it is. Bringing the law, and that's bringing that into darkness. And I will talk about this. This is related to stuff that I'll talk about next week, but there's a sense in which I think we are to understand the Exodus as being a creation-type event. There are similarities between creation and the Exodus. And one of the things that happens in the Exodus is the law is given to the people. And I think that's the light shining into the darkness. That there's a similarity there between those things happening. And so the darkness that needs to be dispelled is our absolute cluelessness spiritually about what are we supposed to be doing? What's right? What's wrong? What's life all about? And the light shining into the darkness is God giving clarity with respect to what is the way? What are we to do? what is right and what is wrong. So the creation was what I think of as a metaphor for the spiritual reality. It's a metaphor built into the physical world, but it's a metaphor for a spiritual reality, and that is God is going to shine light, truth, clarity into what is otherwise darkness. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. You're going to talk about the servant next week?
The servant, yes.
Yeah.
Talk about the identity of the servant.
Yeah, something that maybe I'll just put a bug in here.
Yeah, sure.
The appearance, not an attractive appearance.
Right.
You know, what in the world does that have to do with anything?
I'll make a comment now because I may forget to talk about it next week, but I think that I am right in saying that there is no mention of Jesus' appearance in the Gospels. Does anyone know differently? We don't know whether he was good-looking or bad-looking. I think it's irrelevant to the story. It doesn't matter.
I got a picture in my house that shows him good-looking.
Is he good-looking? Yeah. But I think that it really wouldn't matter whether he was good-looking or bad-looking. I think the point here is that he was not attractive. That he didn't look promising. It didn't look like someone who would accomplish anything worthy of note, worthy of mention.
I've always heard that the comment there was that Jesus is compared to the pagan deities, who are generally large, incredibly the most beautiful image they could create of a human being with, you know, extra faculties like wings or whatever. Mm-hmm. And in the Hall of Gods, I heard a teacher talk once, if you walk through the Hall of Gods, you know, you see Zeus and Adonis and Apollo. He said, Athena, and then there's this little Jewish guy hanging on a cross. And you think, I don't get it, you know? It's like, these represent power and magnificence and physical attractiveness, and this guy represents what? What's he got for me? I mean, that's how I've always heard that.
Yeah.
Sort of. Could you, if you have the time, look into current rabbinical interpretations of the servant passages? Is that part of what you're doing next week?
If I get time. I have found one that was very interesting. Okay. And if I get time, I'll read through it carefully and talk about it.
Thank you.
Their perspective is that the servant here is the nation of Israel or a subset of the nation of Israel. I'll fill that out a little bit next week.
I've got a couple of questions. God's in this relationship with the children of Israel, and it doesn't work out great for the children of Israel in a lot of instances, and they get punished. And then there's this book that explains the punishments, I guess, why they come, and that it's not going to last forever. Do you think that that makes the children of Israel feel, like, understand why the suffering happens? Do you think that they're satisfied when they hear this explanation? They're like, oh, okay, and this is why God sent us to Babylon. This is why God puts us in captivity. This is why all the affliction comes on us. Do you understand the question?
I understand the question. My suspicion is that generally speaking, the Jews don't understand that. And I don't mean, from my perspective, every believer, everyone who comes to real belief, reaches the point where they recognize that no matter how bad the things are that have happened in my life, that I come to understand that they have played a positive role. They've been constructive in my life. And you can actually come to embrace them. That doesn't mean that you like them or change your mind with respect to how bad they were, because they could be very bad. But you understand that in the bigger picture, it all contributed to something positive. God's doing something that is constructive in my life, that he actually loves me, and all that happened, no matter how bad it was, is playing some role in what God is doing in my life, and it's a loving God who's doing that. I think that the nation of Israel has to come to that same realization. And my suspicion is that when the nation of Israel comes to that realization, we will be at the end of history.
It seems like there's a lot of weird things that happen in life that are really terrible, and that God sends a lot of suffering to an individual's life. And the Bible talks a lot about a lot of different things, like maybe explaining why they happen. That's not necessarily the way it is for my life. And what I hear you saying is that there will come a point where you can come to realize that the suffering was for a positive thing, contributed positively, and that you understand that it's a loving God that does it. But sometimes it seems like that maybe the lesson gets rehashed over and over again. You're like, all right, I kind of got what's going on here.
Right.
And it's hard to, I guess the question is, how do you know that it's a loving God? At points, it seems like if God's going to keep hammering on this thing, maybe he's not loving. Maybe he just doesn't like me.
Right.
I mean, I'm a right. sinful being, and he's got a good reason to not like me. Why keep at it? And what assurance do I have aside from the book that tells me that God is actually loving me?
Yeah, exactly. And if you were Jewish and looked at the history of the Jews, you could say the same thing. Where's the proof that God loves us? Doesn't he just pound us all the time? And didn't it happen after Babylon? Didn't it happen during the time of the Nazis? Hasn't it happened since then? Every individual has to look at that and sort that out. Look at all of the evidence and make sense of it. Is God a loving God or is he not? And I think from the biblical perspective, the authors of the Bible would say, yes, he does love you, and there is plenty of evidence to know that that's the case. You just have to give God the benefit of the doubt and then look at the evidence fairly. But there's abundant evidence that God cares for us on a day-to-day basis, and he's working out his purposes.
Thanks.
We better quit. Thanks.